There is a group of churches in Mississippi that is particularly generous. Many are black churches, as it turns out. I just received some letters from them yesterday. One of my classmates at Oral Roberts University has a large congregation near Jackson, Mississippi. His name is Jerry Patterson. We were good friends then, and he remains a friend in Christ. His congregation is large and prosperous, and he still looks after me. You almost added that he had far more money than he knew how to spend. In America, such prosperity would have translated into a Cadillac and a fine parsonage. In Beijing, it meant a nice bicycle and gifts to the needy of his flock. "Where do you live, my friend?" the cardinal asked. The Reverend Yu fished in his pocket for a business card and handed it over. Like many such Chinese cards, it had a sketch map on the back. "Perhaps you would be so kind as to join my wife and myself for dinner. Both of you, of course," he added. "We should be delighted. Do you have children?"
"Two," Yu replied. "Both born in America, and so exempt from the bestial laws the communists have in place here."
"I know of these laws," DeMilo assured his visitor. "Before we can make them change, we need more Christians here. I pray on this subject daily."
"As do I, Eminence, as do I.
I presume you know that your dwelling here is, well..." Shepka tapped his ear and pointed his finger around the room.
"Yes, we know."
"You have a driver assigned to you?"
"Yes, that was very kind of the ministry," Shepka noted. "He's a Catholic. Isn't that remarkable?"
"Is that a fact?" Yu asked rhetorically, while his head shook emphatically from side to side. "Well, I am sure he's loyal to his country as well."
"But of course," DeMilo observed.
It wasn't much of a surprise. The cardinal had been in the Vatican's diplomatic service a long time, and he'd seen most of the tricks at least once. Clever though the Chinese communists were, the Catholic Church had been around a lot longer, loath though the local government might be to admit that fact. The chit-chat went on for another 30 minutes before the Reverend Yu took his leave, with another warm handshake to send him on his way.
"So, Franz," DeMilo asked outside, where a blowing breeze would impede any microphones installed outside the dwelling itself.
"First time I've seen the man. I've heard his name since I arrived here. The PRC government has indeed given him a bad time, and more than once. But he is a man of strong faith and no small courage. I hadn't known of his educational background. We could check on this."
"Not a bad idea," the papal nuncio said.
It wasn't that he distrusted or disbelieved you, just that it was good to be sure of things. Even the name of a classmate, now an ordained minister, Jerry Patterson, somewhere in Mississippi, USA. That would make it easy. The message to Rome went out an hour later, over the Internet, a method of communication that lent itself so readily to intelligence operations. In this case, the time differences worked for them, as sometimes happened when the inquiries went west instead of east. In a few hours, the dispatch was received, decrypted, and forwarded to the proper desk. From there, a new dispatch, also encrypted, made its way to New York, where Timothy Cardinal McCarthy, Archbishop of New York and the chief of the Vatican's intelligence operations in the United States of America, received his copy immediately after breakfast. From there, it was even easier. The FBI remained a bastion of Irish Catholic America, though not so much as in the 1930s, with a few Italians and Poles tossed in. The world was an imperfect place, but when the Church needed information, and as long as the information was not compromising to American national security, it was gotten, usually very quickly. In this case, particularly so. Oral Roberts University was a very conservative institution, and therefore ready to cooperate with the FBI's inquiries, official or not. A clerk there didn't even consult her supervisor. So innocuous was the phoned inquiry from Assistant Special Agent in Charge Jim Brennan of the FBI's Oklahoma City office. It was quickly established via computer records that one Yu Fa An had graduated the university, first with a Bachelor of Science degree in Electrical Engineering, and then spent an additional 3 years in the university for his Doctor of Divinity. Both degrees attained with distinction, the clerk told Brennan, meaning nothing lower than a B+. The alumni office added that the Reverend Yu's current address was in Beijing, China, where he evidently preached the gospel courageously in the land of the pagans. Brennan thanked the clerk, made his notes, and replied to the email inquiry from New York, then went off to his morning meeting with the SAC to review the field division's activities in enforcing federal law in the Sooner State. It was a little different in Jackson, Mississippi. There it was the SAC, Special Agent in Charge, himself, who made the call on Reverend Jerry Patterson's First Baptist Church, located in an upscale suburb of the Mississippi State Capitol. The church was three-quarters of the way into its second century, and among the most prosperous of such congregations in the region. The Reverend Patterson could scarcely have been more impressive, impeccably turned out in a white button-down shirt and a striped blue tie. His dark suit coat was hung in a corner in deference to the local temperature. He greeted the visiting FBI official with regal manners, conducted him to his plush office, and asked how he could be of service. On hearing the first question, he replied, "You? Yes, a fine man, and a good friend from school. We used to call him Skip. Fa sounded too much like something from The Sound of Music, you know. A good guy and a fine minister of the gospel. He could give lessons in faith to Jerry Falwell. Correspond with him? You bet I do. We send him something like $25,000 a year. Want to see a picture? We have it in the church itself. We were both a lot younger then," Patterson added with a smile. "Skip's got real guts. It can't be much fun to be a Christian minister in China, you know. But he never complains. His letters are always upbeat. We could use 1,000 more men like him in the clergy." "So you are that impressed with him?" SAC Mike Leary asked. "He was a good kid in college, and he's a good man today, and a fine minister of the gospel who does his work in a very adverse environment. Skip is a hero to me, Mr. Leary." Which was very powerful testimony indeed from so important a member of the community. First Baptist Church hadn't had a mortgage in living memory, despite its impressive physical plant and amply cushioned pews. The FBI agent stood. "That's about all I need, thank you, sir. Can I ask why you came here to ask about my friend?" Leary had expected that question, and so had pre-framed his answer. "Just a routine inquiry, sir. Your friend isn't in any trouble at all, at least not with the United States government." "Good to know," the Reverend Patterson responded with a smile and a handshake. "You know, we're not the only congregation that looks after Skip." Leary turned. "Really?" "Of course. You know Hosiah Jackson?" "Reverend Jackson, the Vice President's dad?" Never met him, but I know who he is.
Patterson nodded.
Yep. Hosea's as good as they come.
Neither man commented on how unusual it would have been a mere 40 years earlier for a white minister to comment so favorably on a black one. But Mississippi had changed over time, in some ways even faster than the rest of America. I was over at his place a few years ago, and we got talking about things, and this subject came up. Hosea's congregation sends Skip $5,000 or $10,000 a year also, and he organized some of the other black congregations to help us look after Skip as well.
Mississippi whites and blacks looking after a Chinese preacher, Leary thought. What was the world coming to?
He supposed that Christianity might really mean something after all, and headed back to his office in his official car, content at having done some actual investigative work for a change, if not exactly for the FBI. Cardinal McCarthy learned from his secretary that his two requests for information had been answered before lunch, which was impressive even by the standards of the FBI Catholic Church Alliance. Soon after his midday meal, Cardinal McCarthy personally encrypted both of the replies and forwarded them back to Rome. He didn't know why the inquiry had come, but figured that he'd find out in due course if it were important, and if not, then not. It amused the churchman to be the Vatican's master spy in America. It would have amused him less to know that the National Security Agency at Fort Meade, Maryland, was interested in this sideshow activity also, and that their monster Thinking Machines Incorporated supercomputer in the cavernous basement under the main building in the sprawling complex was on the case. This machine, whose manufacturer had gone bankrupt some years before, had been both the pride and joy and the greatest disappointment in the huge collection of computers at NSA, until quite recently, when one of the agency's mathematicians had finally figured out a way to make use of it. It was a massive parallel processing machine, and supposedly operated much as the human brain did, theoretically able to attack a problem from more than one side simultaneously, just as the human brain was thought to do. The problem was that no one actually knew how the human brain worked, and as a result, drafting the software to make full use of the hugely powerful computer had been impossible for some years. This had relegated the impressive and expensive artifact to no more practical utility than an ordinary workstation. But then someone had recognized the fact that quantum mechanics had become useful in the cracking of foreign ciphers, wondered why this should be the case, and started looking at the problems from the programming unit. 7 months later, that intellectual sojourn had resulted in the first of 3 new operating systems for the Thinking Machines Supercruncher, and the rest was highly classified history. NSA was now able to crack any book or machine cipher in the world, and its analysts, newly rich with information, had pitched in to have a woodworker construct a sort of pagan altar to put before the cruncher for the notional sacrifice of goats before their new god. To suggest the sacrifice of virgins would have offended the womenfolk at the agency. NSA had long been known for its eccentric institutional sense of humor. The only real fear was that the world would learn about the tap dance system NSA had come up with, which was totally random, and therefore totally unbreakable, plus easy to manufacture. But it was also an administrative nightmare, and that would prevent most foreign governments from using it. The Cardinal's internet dispatches were copied, illegally but routinely, by NSA and fed into the cruncher, which spat out the clear text, which found its way quickly to the desk of an NSA analyst, who, it had been carefully determined beforehand, wasn't Catholic.
That's interesting, the analyst thought. Why is the Vatican interested in some chink minister? And why the hell did they go to New York to find out about him?
Oh. Okay, educated over here, and friends in Mississippi. What the hell is this all about?
He was supposed to know about such things, but that was merely the theory under which he operated. He frequently didn't know beans about the information he looked at, but was honest enough to tell his superiors that. And so his daily report was forwarded electronically to his supervisor, who looked it over, coded it, and then forwarded it to CIA, where three more analysts looked it over, decided that they didn't know what to make of it either, and then filed it away electronically. In this case, the data went onto VHS-sized tape cassettes, one of which went into storage container Doc, and the other into Grumpy. There are 7 such storage units in the CIA computer room, each named after one of Disney's 7 dwarfs. While the reference names went into the mainframe so that the computer would know where to look for the data for which the United States government, as yet, had no understanding. That situation was hardly unknown, of course, and for that reason, CIA had every bit of information it generated in a computerized and thoroughly cross-referenced index, instantly accessible, depending on classification, to anyone in either the new or old headquarters buildings located one ridgeline away from the Potomac River. Most of the data in the 7 dwarfs just sat there, forevermore to be untouched, footnotes to footnotes, never to be of interest even to the driest of academics.
And so? Zhang Hansan asked.
And so our Russian neighbors have the luck of the devil, Pangan replied, handing the folder over to the senior minister without portfolio. Zhang was 7 years older than Fang, closer to his country's premier. But not that much, and there was little competition between the two ministers.
What we could do with such blessings? His voice trailed off.
Indeed.
That any country could have made constructive use of oil and gold was an obvious truth left unsaid. What mattered here and now was that China would not, and Russia would.
I had planned for this, you know.
Your plans were masterful, my friend, Fang said from his seat, reaching inside his jacket for a pack of cigarettes.
He held it up to seek approval from his host, who'd quit the habit 5 years before. The response was a dismissive wave of the hand, and Fang tapped one out and lit it from a butane lighter.
But anyone can have bad luck. First, the Japanese failed us, and then that religious fool in Tehran, Zhang groused. Had either of our supposed allies performed as promised, the gold and the oil would now be ours. Useful, certainly, for our own purposes. But I am somewhat doubtful on the subject of world acceptance of our notionally prosperous status, Fang said, with a lengthy puff.
The response was yet another wave of the hand.
You think the capitalists are governed by principle? They need oil and gold, and whoever can provide it cheaply gets to sell the most of it. Look whom they buy from, my old friend. Anyone who happens to have it. With all the oil in Mexico, the Americans can't even work up the courage to seize it. How cowardly of them! In our case, the Japanese, as we have learned to our sorrow, have no principles at all. If they could buy oil from the company which made the bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they would. They call it realism, Zhang concluded scornfully.
The real sight came from Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, Lenin himself, who'd predicted, not unreasonably, that capitalist nations would compete among themselves to sell the Soviet Union the rope with which the Russians would later hang them all. But Lenin had never planned for Marxism to fail, had he? Just as Mao hadn't planned for his perfect political/economic vision to fail in the People's Republic, as evidenced by such slogans as, the Great Leap Forward, which, among other things, had encouraged ordinary peasants to smelt iron in their backyards. That the resulting slag hadn't been useful even to make andirons with was a fact not widely advertised in the East or West.
Alas, fortune did not smile upon us, and so the oil and gold are not ours.
For the moment, Zhang murmured.
What was that? Fong asked,
not having quite caught the comment. Zhang looked up, almost startled from his internal reverie.
Hmm?
Oh, nothing, my friend. And with that the discussion turned to domestic matters. It lasted a total of 75 minutes before Fang went back to his office. There began another routine.
Ming, Fang called, gesturing on the way to his inner office. The secretary stood and scampered after him, closing the door behind before finding her seat.
New entry, Fang said tiredly, for it had been a lengthy day. Regular afternoon meeting with Zhang Hansan, and we discussed, his voice went on, relating the substance and contents of the meeting. Ming duly took her notes for her minister's official diary. The Chinese were inveterate diarists, and besides that, members of the Politburo felt both an obligation, for scholarly history, and a personal need, for personal survival, to document their every conversation on matters political and concerning national policy. The better to document their views and careful judgment, should one of their number make an error of judgment. That this meant his personal secretary, as indeed all of the Politburo members' personal secretaries, had access to the most sensitive secrets of the land, was not a matter of importance, since these girls were mere robots, recording and transcription machines. Little more than that.
Well, a little more, Fang and a few of his colleagues thought with the accompanying smile.
You couldn't have a tape machine suck on your penis, could you? And Ming was especially good at it. Fang was a communist, and had been for all of his adult life. But he was not a man entirely devoid of heart, and he had the affection for Ming that another man, or even himself, might have had for a favored daughter.
Except that you usually didn't fuck your own daughter.
His diary entry droned on for 20 minutes, his trained memory recounting every substantive part of his exchange with Zhang, who was doubtless doing the same with his own private secretary right at this moment, unless Zhang had succumbed to the Western practice of using a tape machine, which would not have surprised Fang. For all of Zhang's pretended contempt for Westerners, he emulated them in so many ways. They'd also tracked down the name of Clementi Ivanich Suvorov. He was yet another former KGB officer, part then of the Third Chief Directorate, which had been a hybrid department of the former spy agency, tasked to overseeing the former Soviet military, and also to overseeing certain special operations of the latter force, like the Spetsnaz, Oleg Provolov knew. He turned a few more pages in Suvorov's package, found a photograph and fingerprints, and also discovered that his first assignment had been in the First Chief Directorate, known as the Foreign Directorate, because of its work in gathering intelligence from other nations.
Why the change, he wondered.
Usually in KGB you stayed where you were initially put. But a senior officer in the Third had drafted him by name from the First.
Why?
Suvorov K.I., asked for by name by General Major Pavel Konstantinovich Kabinet. The name made Provolov pause. He'd heard it somewhere, but exactly where he couldn't recall. An unusual state of affairs for a long-term investigator. Provolov made a note and set it aside. So they had a name and a photo for the Suvorov fellow. Had he known Amalric and Zimyanin, the supposed and deceased killers of Avseyenko the pimp? It seemed possible. In the Third Directorate, he would have had possible access to the Spetsnaz, but that could have been a mere coincidence. The KGB's Third Directorate had been mainly concerned with political control of the Soviet military, but that was no longer something the state needed, was it? The entire panoply of political officers, the Zampoliti, who had so long been the bane of the Soviet military, was now essentially gone.
"Where are you now?" Provalov asked the file folder.
Unlike Central Army records, KGB records were usually pretty good at showing where former intelligence officers lived and what they were doing. It was a carryover from the previous regime that worked for the police agencies, but not in this case.
"Where are you?
What are you doing to support yourself? Are you a criminal? Are you a murderer?" Homicide investigations, by their nature, created more questions than answers, and frequently ended with many such questions forever unanswered because you could never look inside the mind of a killer. And even if you could, what you might find there didn't have to make any sort of sense. This murder case had begun as a complex one, and was only becoming more so. All he knew for certain was that Avseyenko was dead, along with his driver and a whore. And now, maybe, he knew even less. He'd assumed almost from the beginning that the pimp had been the real target. But if this Suvorov fellow had hired Amalric and Zimyanin to do the killing, why would a former, he checked, lieutenant colonel in the 3rd Chief Directorate of the KGB, go out of his way to kill a pimp? Was not Sergei Golovko an equally likely target for the killing? And would that not also explain the murder of the two supposed killers, for eliminating the wrong target? The detective lieutenant opened a desk drawer for a bottle of aspirin. It wasn't the first headache this case had developed, and it didn't seem likely that this would be the last. Whoever Suvorov was, if Golovko had been the target, he had not made the decision to kill the man himself. He'd been a contract killer, and therefore someone else had made the decision to do the killing. But who? And why? Cui bono was the ancient question, old enough that the adage was in a dead language. To whom the good? Who profited from the deed? He called Abramov and Ustinov. Maybe they could run Suvorov down, and then he'd fly north to interview the man. Provalov drafted the fax and fired it off to St. Petersburg, then left his desk for the drive home. He checked his watch. Only 2 hours late. Not bad for this case. General Lieutenant Gennady Yosifovich Bondarenko looked around his office. He'd had his 3 stars for a while, and sometimes he wondered if he'd get any farther. He'd been a professional soldier for 31 years, and the job to which he'd always aspired was commanding general of the Russian army. Many good men, and some bad ones, had been there. Grigory Zhukov, for one, the man who'd saved his country from the Germans. There were many statues to Zhukov, whom Bondarenko had heard lecture when he was a wet-nosed cadet all those years before, seeing the blunt, bulldog face and ice-blue, determined eyes of a killer. A true Russian hero whom politics could not demean, and whose name the Germans had come to fear. That Bondarenko had come this far was no small surprise even to himself. He'd begun as a signals officer, seconded briefly to Spetsnaz in Afghanistan, where he'd cheated death twice, both times taking command of a panic-worthy situation and surviving with no small distinction. He'd taken wounds and killed with his own hands, something few colonels do, and few colonels relished, except at a good officers' club bar after a few stiff ones with their comrades. Like many generals before him, Bondarenko was something of a political general. He'd hitched his career star to the coattails of a quasi-minister, Sergei Golovko. But in truth, he'd never have gone to general lieutenant stars without real merit. and courage on the battlefield went as far in the Russian army as it did in any other. Intelligence went farther still, and above all came accomplishment. His job was what the Americans called J-3, Chief of Operations, which meant killing people in war and training them in peace. Bondarenko had traveled the globe, learning how other armies trained their men, sifted through the lessons, and applied them to his own soldiers. The only difference between a soldier and a civilian was training, after all, and Bondarenko wanted no less than to bring the Russian army to the same razor-sharp and granite-hard condition with which it had kicked in the gates of Berlin under Zhukov and Konev. That goal was still off in the future, but the general told himself that he'd laid the proper foundation. In 10 years, perhaps, his army would be at that goal, and he'd be around to see it, retired by then, of course, honorably so, with his decorations framed and hanging on the wall, and grandchildren to bounce on his knee, and occasionally coming in to consult, to look things over and offer his opinion, as retired general officers often did. For the moment he had no further work to do, but no particular desire to head home, where his wife was hosting the wives of other senior officers. Bondarenko had always found such affairs tedious. The military attaché in Washington had sent him a book, Swift Sword, by a Colonel Nicholas Eddington of the American Army National Guard. Eddington. Yes, he was the colonel who'd been training with his brigade in the desert of California when the decision had come to deploy to the Persian Gulf, and his troops, civilians in uniform, really, had performed well. Better than well, the Russian general told himself. They'd exercised the Medusa touch, destroying everything they'd touched, along with the regular American formations, the 10th and 11th Cavalry Regiments. Together, that one division-sized collection of forces had smashed a full 4 corps of mechanized troops like so many sheep in the slaughter pen. Even Eddington's guardsmen had performed magnificently. Part of that, Gennady Yosifovich knew, was their motivation. The biological attack on their homeland had understandably enraged the soldiers, and such rage could make a poor soldier into a heroic one as easily as flipping a light switch. Will to combat was the technical term. In more pedestrian language, it was the reason a man put his life at risk. And so it was a matter of no small importance to the senior officers whose job it was to lead those men into danger. Paging through the book, he saw that this Eddington, also a professor of history, the flap said. Wasn't that interesting? Paid no small attention to that factor. Well, maybe he was smart in addition to being lucky. He'd had the good fortune to command reserve soldiers with many years of service, and while they'd only had part-time practice for their training, they'd been in highly stable units, where every soldier knew every other. And that was a virtually unknown luxury for regular soldiers. And they'd also had the revolutionary new American IVUS gear, which let all the men and vehicles in the field know exactly what their commander knew, often in great detail, and in turn told their commander exactly what his men saw. Eddington said that had made his job a lot easier than any mechanized force commander had ever had it. The American officer also talked about knowing not only what his subordinate commanders were saying, but also the importance of knowing what they were thinking, the things they didn't have the time to say. The implicit emphasis was on the importance of continuity within the officer corps, and that, Bondarenko thought as he made a marginal note, was a most important lesson. He'd have to read this book in detail, and maybe have Washington purchase 100 or so for his brother officers to read. Even get reprint rights in Russia for it? It was something the Russians had done more than once. Chapter 12. Conflicts of the Pocket. Okay, George, let's have it, Ryan said, sipping his coffee. The White House had many routines, and one that had evolved over the past year was that, After the daily intelligence briefing, the Secretary of the Treasury was Ryan's first appointment 2 or 3 days of the week. Winston most often walked across, actually under, 15th Street via a tunnel between the White House and Treasury Building that dated back to the time of FDR. The other part of the routine was that the President's Navy messmen laid out coffee and croissants, with butter, in which both men indulged to the detriment of their cholesterol numbers. The PRC. The trade negotiations have hit the wall pretty hard. They just don't want to play ball. What are the issues? Hell, Jack, what aren't the friggin' issues? Trader took a bite of croissant and grape jelly. That new computer company their government started up is ripping off a proprietary hardware gadget that Dell has patented. That's the new doohickey that kicked their stock up 20%, you know. They're just dropping the things into the boxes they make for their own market and the ones they just started selling in Europe. That's a goddamn violation of all sorts of trade and patent treaties. But when we point that out to them over the negotiating table, they just change the subject and ignore it. That could cost Dell something like $400 million, and that's real money for one company to lose, you know. If I was their corporate counsel, I'd be flipping through the yellow pages for assassins or us. Okay, that's one. Next, they've told us that if we make too big a deal of these minor disagreements, Boeing can forget the 777 order. 28 aircraft they've optioned in favor of Airbus. Ryan nodded. George, what's the trade balance with the PRC now? $78 billion, and it's their way, not ours, as you know. Scott's running this over at Foggy Bottom? Sectrez nodded. He's got a pretty fair team in place, but they need a little more in the way of executive direction. And what's this doing to us? Well, it gets our consumers a lot of low-cost goods, about 70% of which is in low-tech stuff. Lots of toys, stuffed animals, like that. But, Jack, 30% is upscale stuff. That amount's almost doubled in 2.5 years. Pretty soon that's going to start costing us jobs, both in terms of production for domestic consumption and lost exports. They're selling a lot of laptops domestically. In their country, I mean. But they don't let us into the market, even though we've got 'em beat in terms of performance and price. We know for sure they're taking part of their trading surplus with us and using it to subsidize their computer industries. They want to build that up for strategic reasons, I suppose. Plus selling weapons to people we'd prefer not to have them, POTUS added. Which they also do for strategic reasons. Well, doesn't everybody need an AK-47 to take care of his gophers? A shipment of 1,400 true, that is, fully automatic, assault rifles had been seized in the port of Los Angeles 2 weeks before. But the PRC had denied responsibility, despite the fact that U.S. intelligence services had tracked the transaction order back to a particular Beijing telephone number. That was something Ryan knew, but it had not been allowed to leak, lest it expose methods of intelligence collection. In this case, to the National Security Agency at Fort Meade. The new Beijing telephone system hadn't been built by an American firm, but much of the design work had been contracted to a company that had made a profitable arrangement with an agency of the United States government. It wasn't strictly legal, but different rules were attached to national security matters. They just don't play by the rules, do they? Winston grunted. Not hardly.
Suggestions? President Ryan asked.
Remind the little slant-eyed fucks that they need us a shitload more than we need them.
You have to be careful talking like that to nation-states, especially ones with nuclear weapons, Ryan reminded his Treasury secretary. Plus the racial slur.
Jack, either it's a level playing field or it isn't. Either you play fair or you don't. If they keep that much more of our money than we do of theirs, then it means they've got to start playing fair with us.
Okay, I know. He held his hands up defensively. Their noses are a little out of joint over Taiwan, but that was a good call, Jack. You did the right thing punishing them. Those little fucks killed people, and they probably had complicity in our last adventure in the Persian Gulf, and the Ebola attack on us, and so they had it coming. But no, we can't punish them for murder and complicity in an act of war on the United States, can we? We have to be too big and strong to be so petty. Petty my ass, Jack. Directly or indirectly, those little bastards helped that Darii guy kill 7,000 of our citizens, and establishing diplomatic relations with Taiwan was the price they paid for it. And a damn small price that was, if you ask me. They ought to understand that. They've got to learn that the world has rules. So what we have to do is show them that there's pain when you break the rules, and we have to make the pain stick. Until they understand that, there's just going to be more trouble. Sooner or later, they have to learn. I think it's been long enough to wait. Okay, but remember their point of view. Who are we to tell them the rules? Horseshit, Jack! Winston was one of the very few people who had the ability, if not exactly the right, to talk that way in the Oval Office. Part of it came from his own success, part of it from the fact that Ryan respected straight talk, even if the language was occasionally off-color. Remember, they're the ones sticking it to us. We are playing fair. The world does have rules, and those rules are honored by the community of nations. And if Beijing wants to be part of that community, well, then they have to abide by the same rules that everyone else does. If you want to join the club, you have to pay the cost of admittance, and even then, you still can't drive your golf cart on the greens. You can't have it both ways. The problem, Ryan reflected, was that the people who ran entire nations, especially large, powerful, important nations, were not the sort to be told how or why to do anything at all. This was all the more true of despotic countries. In a liberal democracy, the idea of the rule of law applied to just about everyone. Ryan was president, but he couldn't rob a bank just because he needed pocket change. George, okay. Sit down with Scott and work something out that I can agree to, and we'll have State explain the rules to our friends in Beijing. And who knows, maybe it might even work this time. Not that Ryan would bet money on it. This would be the important evening, Nomori thought. Yeah, sure, he'd banged Ming the night before, and she seemed to have liked it. But now that she'd had time to think it over, would her reaction be the same? Or would she reflect that he'd plied her with liquor and taken advantage of her? Nomori had dated and bedded his share of women, but he didn't confuse amorous successes with any sort of understanding of the female psyche. He sat at the bar of the medium-sized restaurant, different from the last one, smoking a cigarette, which was new for the CIA officer. He wasn't coughing, though his first two had made the room seem to spin around some. Carbon monoxide poisoning, he thought. Smoking reduced the oxygen supply to your brain, and was bad for you in so many ways. But it also made waiting a lot easier. He'd bought a Bic lighter, blue, with a facsimile of the PRC flag on it, so that it appeared like their banner was waving in a clear sky. Yeah, he thought, sure. And here I am wondering if my girl will show up, and she's already... He checked his watch. 9 minutes late. Nomori waved to the bartender and ordered another scotch. It was a Japanese brand, drinkable, not overly expensive. And when you got down to it, booze was booze, wasn't it? "Are you coming, Ming?" the case officer's mind asked the air around him.